This is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we're highlighting the life and legacy of one woman who has made a very big impact on the early production of Jazz Fest. Then we'll share the latest episode of The Listening Post and another story from Bring Your Own. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. Stay with us. There's one woman who has left a lasting impact on the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, all while being extremely instrumental in the festival's production, and her name is Allison Miner. She was an archivist, music manager, promoter, and a New Orleans music enthusiast. Here to talk more about Miner's life and legacy is cultural anthropologist Helen Regis and archivist for the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, Rachel Lyons. Ladies, welcome.
Thank you, Janae.
So let's set the scene for our listeners. The year is 1967, a few years before the first ever New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. Where is Allison Miner at this time?
Allison, prior to working at the festival, was working at the Louisiana State Museum. She developed a very close friendship with Mary Lynn Costa, who is still here in New Orleans. And so she was becoming immediately deeply immersed in Louisiana culture and learning more about not just the music, but also the history of the state and the city.
How did Allison Miner get involved with Jazz Fest?
Well, she was working at the Hogan Jazz Archive at Tulane University, where she was working with the archivist
Dick Allen.
Dick Allen.
Okay.
And Dick Allen was one of the advisors to the early festival. So when George Ween was asked to organize the festival that began in 1970, he went to Dick Allen and said, "Do you know some people who could help me to do some of the footwork to organize this festival?" Mm-hmm. And Dick Allen invited Allison to lunch with George.
Let's talk more about that first year of Jazz Fest. First off, it happened at Congo Square. How long was it at Congo Square before migrating to the fairgrounds?
2 years. It was in Congo Square, so 70 and 71.
Okay. And let's talk about the role of Allison Miner doing those early years of Jazz Fest.
So Allison, along with Quint, did a lot of the organizing in terms of finding musicians and finding, you know, people who might sell food at the festival. And so they did a lot of, you know, what in anthropology we would call field work. Basically, you know, moving through the city, going to church, talking to people and saying, "Wow, your fried chicken is really good. Would you like to sell it at Jazz Fest?"
Yeah.
You know, or "We would love to have your gospel choir come and perform." So part of what they were doing were bringing people in who, in some cases, they were professional musicians who had gone into retirement, right? In other cases, they were people who didn't think of themselves as professional musicians, but who had, you know, who made beautiful music, right? So that was part of the, I think, the heritage part of Jazz and Heritage, right, is that they were basically working to identify groups that had never been on a larger stage, right? They were known and loved in their own communities, such as in their own church, right, but not in the larger city. So the festival created that space. And so in that sense, the festival was one of the early institutions in New Orleans, and I think the organizers really prided themselves in that, to create an opportunity for people in mixed settings to be black and white together in an audience, right? This is something that they talked about a lot.
We mentioned the role that Allison played, but I think we need to stress the fact that she wasn't on the board. She was snuck into board meetings, you know. So let's talk about how, as a woman, she was still belittled.
Yeah, I mean, she's such an interesting figure in that way, because she clearly had a lot of knowledge, and through her work at the archive, at the State Museum, and in many ways she was self-taught. She never had an opportunity to go to college, but she did learn a lot about history and music and culture in New Orleans and Louisiana. But that knowledge was often not recognized by the institutions, right? And so she was making her own way. I mean, she was helping to create a festival, but it wasn't automatic that she would be given credit for that at that time in that era.
Right. Now, in regards to her work with Jazz Fest, Miner mentions allowing herself to be used in a documentary in the early 90s. Could you clarify that?
I think when she was talking to the filmmaker Amy Nesbitt, she was at a time where she was very ill and she was looking over her life, and she was, you know, both reviewing her accomplishments and the, you know, the really beautiful things that she got to experience, but she was also reviewing, you know, some injustice that she lived through in her life. So I think that she probably regretted that she wasn't credited and maybe paid for some of the work that she did for the festival.
Yeah, that's right, because the first year she wasn't paid at all, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And she was the bookkeeper. You know, she went out and she did the field work, as you mentioned. So a lot of injustice there during those times.
Mm-hmm.
I think... And I do need to clarify that I had never actually met Allison. I knew who she was because I had a lot of friends back in the 90s that worked at Jazz Fest. But she and I had never really met or spoken. But I think similar to what Helen was saying, she was clearly a very smart young woman. She left home very young to come to New Orleans. So she was just 17 when she arrived here.
Okay.
And at that point, I think a lot of us would still be raising ourselves. And I think that that's a little bit about not quite being holy as a woman. So when she's looking back on herself and she says, you know, perhaps I let people use me. I think that that also goes with an experience that we all have. And I think that it's really important to remember that aspect of it. It was not only did she not go to college, but she was extraordinarily young when she got here and fell into these things. But she was also a smart, young, capable woman.
Now, Minor worked with the Jazz Fest for years before leaving and returning. Let's talk about that time.
So Allison worked on the festival until the 1975 festival. And then after that, she eventually got married and they moved away so that her husband could pursue his career. But while she was away, she still came back every year for the festival. So she was involved with it to one degree or another. And a big avenue in was through WWOZ Radio.
I was going to say, when we think about her legacy, one of the most important things she did was she worked to make sure that the festival remained a nonprofit, that it would belong to the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, and that the profits, if any, would be invested back into the community, that they would stay in New Orleans, and that they would help go towards helping musicians, helping to promote and preserve New Orleans music and the cultural heritage of the city. The festival was started as a nonprofit, which a lot of people don't know.
Right.
But there were certain moments in its history when it was starting to make a profit, when you know, there were some people involved who maybe wanted it to change its status.
Okay.
So she was really instrumental in making sure that it stayed a nonprofit and that it would belong to the people of New Orleans.
Okay. Jazz Fest now has a stage actually named after Minor. Let's talk about that.
When Allison returned to New Orleans, she subsequently had gotten divorced, and she moved back to New Orleans in 1987. And at that point, she went back, and of course, as she had always continued to have a relationship with the festival, but met with Quint Davis, who at that point had become the primary producer. And of course, George Ween was still the executive producer, and talked to him about wanting to sort of rekindle a little bit more of the intimacy of what the previous festivals had been. And that was when they started, at the time it was just called the Music Heritage Stage. And she was put in charge of producing and booking and managing that stage. So the first year of that stage was 1988. And then subsequently they started audio recording it in 1989. And she managed that stage until her passing.
Wow, and that's great. And you know, she was so authentic. Let's talk about the relationship that she shared with musicians and her impact on the music business, especially here in New Orleans.
Well, one of the things she did after she returned to New Orleans from Cleveland was that she started her own music management company. One of her first clients were the Rebirth Brass Band, and they've talked with us about how she was really helpful in, they were young musicians, they were in their early 20s, in learning about the music business and learning, for example, to control their own publishing. And later on, when the Fraser brothers, Philip and Keith Fraser, went on to manage the Rebirth on their own, they implemented what they had learned from her. And they credit that knowledge with what's allowed them to keep the band going for so long, for over 20, 25 years.
Yeah, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Helen Regis, Rachel Lyons, thanks for joining me today.
So nice talking with you.
Allison Minor died of bone marrow cancer in December of 1995. She was 46 years old. Southeastern Louisiana relies on federal funds to keep it a viable place to live. That means constant construction, roads, levees, and the latest project, a $951 million plan to widen the Industrial Canal. And while the Army Corps of Engineers has reached out to the surrounding communities for input, the proposal is wildly unpopular. The Listening Post wanted to hear both sides of the debate.
Welcome to The Listening Post. I'm your host, Thomas Walsh.
This may look like a little rundown neighborhood to you, but this is our neighborhood. Our families have worked.
Lori Parker has lived in the Lower Ninth Ward for more than 60 years. At a citizens' meeting in her neighborhood, she stands before a panel of Army Corps engineers.
We will not, we cannot, we must not let you destroy what we have created.
Parker and around 40 of her neighbors are at this meeting. They're here to voice their concerns for a refurbished Inner Harbor Navigational Canal, commonly known as the Industrial Canal, that separates the Lower Ninth from the rest of the city. The lock is nearly 100 years old, and it's too small, according to the Army Corps. Now, this is really troublesome for barges. We'll have to wait as long as 16 hours to get through the lock, the longest such delays in the nation.
That's the barge.
The expansion project would speed up barge traffic and generate $173 million a year, according to the Corps. But the rub? It'll cost nearly $1 billion and take at least 13 years to complete.
They'll be changing out bridges. We know there'll be problems with traffic because of that. Businesses here would suffer.
That's John Cofurl, president of Citizens Against Widening the Industrial Canal, and a property owner in the Holy Cross neighborhood. He stands near the St. Claude Bridge as a barge exits from the lock.
There'll be a lot of vibration because of the pile driving that needs to be done for the new lock and the dynamiting out of the old lock. The risk is gratuitous. I mean, it doesn't really need to happen, you know?
Now, there's no official plan for dynamiting the bridge, at least not yet. That's just John speculating.
Slowly but surely, here comes the barge, huh?
Despite community meetings, Cofurl doesn't feel like the residents are being heard.
It's a siloed kind of planning that doesn't involve other minds besides their own. It's not working for us.
So what can the Corps do to earn the neighborhood's trust?
Just be more open and inclusive in planning, you know, more transparent. That would be a start. We have no history with the Corps to say that that we trust them, you know? We don't.
So trust is obviously a big issue behind this whole project. In fact, trust, community, and communication seem to be the three big points around which this entire conversation is spinning. And to take this conversation a step further, I'm joined here by Claudia Lopez.
Hello.
I'm looking forward to getting into these results with you. We did our traditional survey at the libraries this month, but we did things a little bit different, didn't we, Claudia?
So this month we stopped at the New Salem Baptist Church in the Upper Ninth Ward and kind of sat in on a community voice meeting that went over this project that the Army Corps is trying to introduce to the Lower Ninth Ward or to this area in general. I mean, there were people who were teachers, there were elderly community members, there were younger community members who really just wanted to come out and sit down and hear what was going on.
And a big part of it was to try to raise awareness in the community, because from what we learned, this issue actually is kind of a little bit more under the radar than you might expect.
Yeah, a lot of people either don't know about it or don't understand the great impact that it can have on them.
So for the people who were there, we got a chance to speak with them, and you and I got some results. Shall we give them a listen?
We should.
There's more power in numbers, as I know, and you know.
We live in a community that has been dealing with environmental racism since pretty much the dawn of time in New Orleans. These are the same people who were washed away in Katrina. These are the same people who were left out to dry. These are the same people who just finished rebuilding their houses. And now they want to ask people to move their homes for 13 plus years.
Compensation is not everything. We need some more input from the community as far as how we want to build our communities.
I lived in the Lower Ninth Ward for 2 years, and I think this project ignores the historical context of the neighborhood as well as its citizens.
Let's sit down and we work on this together. Where can we put this thing at? Where can we move this at? You know? I mean, let's sit down and work on it together. Not you. Well, we're just going to have that meeting here, what they got to say. But our mind is already made up where we're going to put it at. We're going to put it here. You know? Yeah, so that's the thing. Let's sit down and work on this together, you know?
Really great results from our meeting. We hope that we'll get a chance to go out and kind of pursue this model again over the next coming months. We are still doing our survey results the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, you can still find us at the Mid-City Library, at the Alvar Library, and of course through our cell phone number at 504-303-4348.
Find us on Twitter, find us on Instagram, and check us out at listeningpostnola.com.
Central Lobby Security, how can I help you?
After touching base with our Listening Post community, we took the results of what people said back to the Army Corps.
No, Central Lobby.
Ricky Boyette, Chief of Public Affairs, was interested in what the neighborhood had to say.
When it comes to community input, I think we would agree with the residents that they should have a lot.
One of the big complaints from residents is that the Army Corps has been shaky with the details. But Boyette says there's a reason for that.
We call it the 3x3x3 plan. And that means that studies now are going to be conducted in 3 years with $3 million and with three levels of the Corps working at it concurrently.
The Corps starts making decisions before the full designs are finalized in order to expedite planning. The public hears fewer details because there are fewer details. But the approach allows for more community input, which can impact the project.
It's being able to look at the data, collect as much information we can, so that when it comes time to make a recommendation, we've made it using the best science and engineering available. And then over time, that follow-through performs as it was designed to do. That's how you build trust.
So this project, well, it's far from over. In fact, it's barely begun. Boyette says the plan won't be submitted for congressional approval until the end of next year. And in the meantime, public concern will certainly grow. The Corps has been granted congressional immunity for this project, so they can't be sued if something goes wrong during construction, like, for example, if a natural disaster breaches construction and floods the neighborhood. Boyette's empathetic for the residents and understands that they're being asked to make a sacrifice.
They believe that they're impacted far greater than they will benefit from it. And that's understandable, right? For any project that we look at, is it in the public interest is a question we have to answer. And if it's not a yes, then we don't go forward. In this case, our early indications are that the benefits will outweigh the detriments.
It's safe to say that not everyone agrees with him. That's it for this episode of the Listening Post. Thanks for tuning in, New Orleans. And remember, our microphone is your microphone. We'll see you next time.
And we're back with more BYO. This story was told on December 15, 2016 at The Propeller and later produced by Colleen McLellan. The theme of the evening was Moved. And here, Mr. Garcia chronicles the fight for liberty, justice, and employment in the land of opportunity.
My name is Fausto Garcia. When I first came here, I came on an H-2B visa, and I came to work in the seafood industry. I was working in a catfish plant. I didn't want to come here. I had to. My country was in constant economic crisis. I couldn't survive, and my family couldn't survive. I had the opportunity to come here on an H-2B visa. I thought I'd hit the jackpot when I was issued this H-2B visa. But then I realized once I came into the country and they stamped my passport, not only with the stamp from the country, but rather of my employer and his actual name, that I had become property. And if you try to do anything about it, it's part of the visa that they can punish you for 5 to 10 years. And that leads to a situation where many people don't speak out about the conditions. I thought that I had come to the United States thinking, all right, this is going to be good. But when I got to my job, I saw that all of my coworkers and I were standing in knee-deep water, putrefied, rotten water. Apart from the conditions, there was also abuse on the part of the managers, and that was something that I lived with my own flesh and blood. And it wasn't just me, it was my coworkers who received the same treatment. Obscene language, they would shout at us, and finally they would hit us. They beat me. They beat me because some fish had fallen on the floor. That was their justification for humiliating me in front of all of my coworkers, for hitting me. Probably the worst part about it wasn't the actual beating. It was the fact that I felt like I couldn't say anything. Because I had paid a lot of money to get this visa, I had actually gone into debt, and my entire family, including my children, were now living out the consequences of my decision. That experience was something really difficult for me, knowing that my family in Mexico was suffering, I was suffering, but I didn't take it for too long, because I've always been a bit of a rebel. I said, I'm out, I'm leaving. But my coworkers, none of them wanted to leave. I said, come on, lift your chins up, have a little bit of dignity. Look at what they're doing to us. But they were all too afraid and too in debt to want to do anything about it. And I left knowing that I could be punished for 5 to 10 years. That's what they had promised me. And so time passed. I went back to Mexico, and I decided I would try again. I came back again under another H-2B visa. At a different company. And I really didn't want to come necessarily, but I also wanted to find out, was anything going to happen to me? I felt like I had to come, and I wanted to see if anything was going to happen to me. Well, nothing happened. I started working again for another 10 long years. The conditions weren't that much better, but it was a little different. I knew how to weather them now, and so I stayed on. It was a little more bearable. It was during those 10 years that I found out about the National Guest Workers Alliance, and I liked what they were doing, defending labor rights, defending workers. I had always tried to do things to help people who were in the same situation as I was, often vulnerable. But as a result of my involvement with the NGA, my employer put me on a blacklist. They didn't want to let me come back and work because they were afraid of the organizing that I would bring to their plants. I was forced to go back to Mexico, but the NGA helped me put in a labor complaint. It was a really big victory that we won. That's why I'm here today. The Department of Labor forced my boss to pay me 1 year of back wages for the year that I was in Mexico where I couldn't work. And then they said that if I wanted my job back, that my employer would have to take me back. But they didn't think that I would actually want to go back. They said, would you really go back to work there after all of this fight that you had with your boss and after all the abuse that you endured? But I said yes. I said yes because I wanted to set a precedent. I wanted to show that you shouldn't be afraid to organize, and I wanted to change that plant and that industry. So I guess I want to leave you with this, that we need to leave fear behind, and that's why I'm here today. Thank you.
That event was held in partnership with the New Orleans Workers Center for Racial Justice. The next BYO is on Thursday, May 11th at the LGBT Community Center and is in partnership with Queer Histories, Queer Futures. For more information or to hear more stories, check out bringyourownstories.com and follow BYO on Instagram and Twitter at BYO Stories. And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Follow me on Twitter at Miss Janae Pierre, and feel free to tweet comments or questions. Would you like to suggest a guest or topic? Send an email to janae@wwno.org. That's janae@wwno.org. We'll be back with you next week here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. Thanks for joining us.